The Brendan O'Connor Show on RTE Radio 1 with All Care Pharmacy. Advice and expertise on the relief you need from hay fever at All Care Community Pharmacies across Ireland. The Brendan O'Connor Show on RTE Radio 1 with All Care Pharmacy. Advice and expertise from your healthcare team at All Care, taking care of communities across Ireland. The Brendan O'Connor Show on RTE Radio 1 with All Care Pharmacy. Advice and expertise from your healthcare team at All Care, taking care of communities across Ireland.
Good morning, you're all very, very welcome to the Brendan O'Connor Show. I'm Dervil MacDonald, sitting in for Brendan this weekend. You're all very, very welcome to the programme. I'm feeling a little bit jinxed after yesterday's gardening item with Diarmaid Gavin and Paul Smith having come home and seen hundreds of hornets flying above my house. I don't know if they jinxed me yesterday. Will we have a hornet's nest when we get to our panel that are with me this morning? Let's wait and see. Before I introduce you to them, let's have a little quick look at what is making the headlines this morning in your newspapers. Guns and bombs get past airport security is the lead story for the Irish Mail on Sunday. A report by John Lee reveals that seven prohibited devices, including guns, managed to pass through scanners and security staff during the safety audit. The Sunday Times leads with a story by Brian Mahan that Fianna Fáil believes political opponents are using bot accounts bought from so-called click farms to discredit members and create a false impression about the party. Twitter's actually deactivated more than 600 accounts after a tweet by Health Minister Stephen Donnelly on the National Maternity Hospital was retweeted by more than 300 accounts based in Turkey. The Sunday Business Post leads on housing with a report by Killian Woods that a clause in the new €450 million state subsidy scheme for developers will allow people who purchase apartments through the scheme to pocket as much as 80% of any profit if they choose to flip the property. And finally to the Sunday Independent, where Hugh O'Connell has secured details of a cabinet memo, a sensitive cabinet memo, which has warned that the arrival of tens of thousands of Ukrainian refugees into towns and cities across the country poses a risk to social cohesion and integration, particularly among deprived communities. It also carries an interview with suspended Green Party TD Nessa Hourigan, who along with her party colleague Patrick Costello voted against the government last week, and I know we'll get to that shortly with the panel. Your tabloids this morning, it's a rather bleak crime frenzy fallout right across the tabloids this morning, with reports in the Sunday World of a sickening firebomb attack on the home of a woman whose son was murdered earlier this year, and an interview in the Irish Sun on Sunday with the partner of murdered boxer Kevin Sheehy. The Irish Sunday Mirror features a report on John Shaw, Ireland's longest serving prisoner, who's been granted temporary release, I think of just 2 days, after 46 years in prison. Meanwhile, the Daily Star Sunday splashes with a much more optimistic headline. Special Forces is the headline there, after the Ukrainian army rescued a Russian army dog who was very, very in a very bad state, but he's now been burst back to health and he's working for Ukraine now. So he has switched sides, and it's a great picture. Across the Irish Sea to the UK, the monkeypox outbreak there and the global food crisis dominate. With the Jubilee appearance, I thought this was hilarious when I looked at it last night. The Prince of Wales and the Duchess of Cornwall are going to appear in a special episode of EastEnders, the future King and Queen secretly filmed the episode in March, and that is going to be broadcast next month. It'll be interesting to see it. Anyway, they seemed like pretty good sports. But anyway, back to that hornet's nest or not. Joining me live in studio this morning is Philip Ryan, political editor at Independent Newspapers, Dan Boyle, Green Party councillor and former TD, senator and chairperson of the Green Party at Cork City South Central. I'm also joined by Dr. Jennifer Kavanagh, law lecturer in South Eastern Technological University. You're all very, very welcome this morning. I want to talk about the fallout of the vote in respect of the National Maternity Hospital, and a really, really interesting interview with Nessa Hourigan, one of the two suspended Green Party TDs. Can you just remind us quickly what actually happened this week?
Yeah, so this is the long-running debate, which hasn't ended still, and I think we'll be talking about it on these shows and others for some time to come, around the site for the new National Maternity Hospital. It came to a head this week because Sinn Féin put down a motion on where it should move, and they had the support of the opposition, clearly. But the government then put down a motion saying they would abstain on it. So they didn't have to make any decision and the vote would go through and there'd be no harm done and there'd be no vote. But then a group of the left-wing TDs, who aren't big fans of the church, and a group of the rural independents, who are big fans of the church, came together and put down an amendment to the motion which would force a vote. And then it was put up to Nasa Hourigan and to Patrick Costello that they did have to vote on this. And they did, and they made it quite clear beforehand that they weren't comfortable voting in favour of the government's position on this. So they lost their party whip. And Eamon Ryan, the Green Party leader, acted quite swiftly in then suspending them both for 6 months from the party.
And in terms of the, you know, how serious or not the suspension is compared, I suppose, to the previous incidents where party political leaders have had to deal with errant TDs and senators, where does it lie?
Yeah, it seems to be the 6 months is the standard punishment for breaching the whip. We saw it on other occasions. We've also saw it around the time of the Golfgate situation. It seems to be that is the standard practice. I don't think it's written down anywhere in legislation, maybe within, obviously not in legislation, but maybe within party structures. And the Green Party and Eamon Ryan really did have to do at least that this time around, because the last time it was a 2 month ban, and 6 weeks of that was a Dáil recess, and it was only they were taking away their speaking rights within the Dáil. Now there is still some queries around the position that Nasa Hourigan holds of a chair of an Oireachtas committee, which entitles her to an extra around €10,000. Whether she will hold on to that in these circumstances, which she seems to at this stage.
Can I just chat to you, Jennifer, about it? And I suppose I should declare an interest as somebody, as a business journalist who wrote about this story for a long, long time, and became convinced that it was less about God and more about mammon. But it's interesting in Nessa Harrigan's interview, which I think is interesting on a number of levels, that it is less about the ethos debate which is dominated, and it's more actually the concern about procurement that informed her decision.
Yeah, and also locking the state into kind of a public-private partnership type relationship, which seems to be against what Sláintecare is supposed to be all about. But the whole National Maternity Hospital, the best way now to actually describe it is something from the thick of it, an omni-shambles. Because there's so many different angles that you can actually attack this from, whether it's the church, whether it's the procurement. I mean, we still have with the National Children's Hospital, how much is that going to cost? Obviously, you know, inflation is hitting everything, including building costs. So whatever they say the National Maternity Hospital will cost now, it will probably cost a lot more than that before anyone is actually going through the doors.
And I suppose we should probably remind listeners that that when it was first sanctioned and agreed, it signed off in 2013.
Yeah.
Obviously, the costs were much, much less significant than they are now. And as you say, it sort of speaks to a lot of the complexity of the issues, not least because this is actually the bringing together of two voluntary hospitals.
And bringing together any organisations that were separate, there's always going to be challenges. But one thing that really struck me with the 2 week delay on signing off on it was the criticism of people who were giving out about it and how they were delaying it. People were giving out in 2013, and the newspapers were full of the coverage back then. And it's the whole idea that these problems were well flagged. People had issues about how much would it cost, what would be the connection of the religious orders, etc. And to turn around and say that within a 2 week time period that anyone who's giving out now only wants to delay it when people have been giving out since the very start of this even idea.
I suppose, Dan Boyle, it's been a complex 10-year project. Many of the issues have been flagged, it's been dealt with. Is it not a sign of political health that issues are raised and dealt with and changed and amended? Is that not a sign of the health of the system as well as the weaknesses?
Well, you would hope that would be the case and we should have more of it. I think the problem is the length of time the processes take. When I was a TD, the issue was the National Children's Hospital itself, and that was being promoted by then Taoiseach Bertie Ahern as the Mater Hospital site, and then it became the St James's Hospital site. And the public debate that surrounded whether or not would happen or not and the delay that subsequently happened was about various interest groups, ironically enough the consultants in those cases who objected both to the matter and St James's as sites, which delayed the implementation of building and the eventual cost of it. With the National Maternity Hospital, the consultants, with the exception of the former master Peter Boylan, seemed to be very much at idem in relation into this particular process, and the opposition is coming from other sources based on on an association with religious ethos, but as you indicated yourself, it seems to be about the land. It's about the ownership of the land. It's about potential profit and availability of that profit for a commercial group. And that area that Nessa is right, that the public-private combination in our health service is something that we need to tackle.
The dismantling, I suppose, of... Is it about the dismantling of religious influence, or is it actually the complexity of a health system that has public, private and voluntary?
We are still dealing with a fish nor fowl health service. And the problem is that in terms of having a bit of each, it's more costly than it needs to be. And its delivery to those who need it most is most affected.
And as we've often said, if you think healthcare is bad, wait till you hear about schools. Philip, it is a quite a point that is being made. Look, you know, obviously all of the consultants and others, Brenda Parr has a piece, you know, who are saying that, you know, there's huge support with that. But actually, in fact, it's sort of moved on to that now to become the political issue. I see Colin McCarthy has a big piece about how this fits in the whole scheme of how Ireland handles major capital infrastructure projects or doesn't, and including costs. So on the one level, there's the money, the mammon, and now it's actually moved on to the broader political fallout of this. And when you look across the papers this morning, there's no agreement. You know, see, Jodie Corcoran has a piece saying history will begin this point is the beginning of the end for the government. But on the same page, you have another one saying, actually, this is not, it's not as big as it seems in the big scheme of things. So where's your sense of it at present?
I think that what emboldened the government last week and allowed them to make the decision was that they realise that there isn't the public outcry over this, that maybe could be presented when you read the media or you go online or you go on Twitter.
Twitter in particular.
Yeah, there isn't that backlash out there. We saw the protest last week wasn't as big as maybe some of the support or organisers would have hoped. So that's always the litmus test for the government. What is the public mood on this thing?
But where are the numbers politically now? Remind us in terms of with those suspensions.
Yes. So that's two gone. The government already lost Mark McSharry as well. So they're down three and there's I think it's 79-80 at the moment. In the government's favour. So that's kind of tight when it comes down to serious and significant votes that can collapse, whether it's a confidence motion, whether it's the budget. Now, the government also relies and can do in many instances on some of the independents that we've seen over the years, like it's a Michael Lowry, Noel Grealish, they'll support the government.
And even Nessa Harrigan herself is saying, you know, I'm not likely to vote against them, but does it once again transfer over power to the independents and others, particularly where there's going to be a lot of crunch points in next month with inflation, with interest rates and with other issues that have been flagged?
Yeah, look, it's playing into the hands of Sinn Féin and they'll be sitting around and strategising and trying to find a way. Is there a way to put something awkward on the table that the government, that could potentially bring down the government over? And it's one of those things, it's hard to see what is going to come around the corners. Obviously, the budget's going to be a big one. People are going to want the cost of living situation addressed. And then there's other issues around just the economy, like how sustainable is all this spending and when does it come to an end?
Jennifer, John Drennan has a piece in the Irish Mail on Sunday saying that Sinn Féin has, what is it, got 6 months to eyeing a knockout punch, with even reports that the Chief Whip contacted ministers this week warning ministers not to travel abroad without security. Permission first. Is it a vulnerability that you think Sinn Féin can exploit successfully?
Well, the way I look at it is it could be a great 6 months for roundabouts and ring roads because this is the time where if you are an independent who is generally supports the government, you've been elected in on specific issues that are important to your local area, this is the time when you need to start making your hay. Because you would be you're in a much stronger position. But look, we've been in situations where numbers have been very tight around the time when we had the bailout. I remember even being in the public gallery, everyone was just about hoping that somebody was going to vote a different way to the way the government wanted them to vote. And it's really, it is part and parcel of how politics actually operates. And when you have tighter numbers, sometimes it means that what gets voted through is a little bit better thought out because you can't rely on just having large numbers to push something through. You have to be able to explain it as well. But we will have the summer break coming up, so that will cover some of those 6 months. And I think we'll probably have the people who like watching politics will have a bit more fun than usual. But yeah. I think that's probably the sum total that it will be.
Dan, you know, did Nessa Horrigan get it right, do you think, in voting against the government on this issue?
Well, it's not a vote I would have made.
From a man who voted against the government,
I know,
is there any difference between what Ness has done and what you have done?
And myself and Deirdre de Burker voted against second stage proceeding on a criminal justice bill that lacked a sunset clause because we weren't sure it had been approved to government. But it wasn't a major thing. And neither was this, to be honest, because it was a non-binding vote and the government had chosen to abstain. So the reality is that by voting on it, you drew attention to something that was going to happen anyway or not happen in the case of a non-effective vote. And on grounds that were not really what she was arguing about, because we've talked about already the fact...
She was under pressure from her constituents. You were under pressure as Green Party chair.
Yeah, there are elements of that. As with most disagreements within the Green Party, it comes down to strategy rather than content. I think the title there mentions McCarthyism.
Yeah, she says McCarthyism is not great in any political party. Yeah. It's really, really malign. She also says that, she was saying she was... Because she had voted against the whip for the second time in 2 years, she said she wasn't surprised at the severity of her punishment. Mm. She accepted it, but she said she was surprised her party colleague Patrick Costello was hit with the same sanction, considering she said it was his first, and it says, in air quotes, offence. She says, it's like any political party, we're all equal, but some are more equal than others, and that's all I'm going to say about that.
Well, I mean, McCarthyism is a bit overblown in the sense that if the Greens yeah. creating problems for ourselves...
Were you sanctioned?
No, because it had to do with whether or not a government decision had been made or not. So it was a bit more uncertain. And it was the Senate, so it didn't have an effect on the overall legislation. Yeah. Mm. But the thing is that Greens create problems for ourselves, both in a parliamentary and national sense, in the sense that we are the most open of political parties, that we have active engagement in debates, and we air our disagreements probably to public nature.
But party politics, though, is that you do have those debates.
And we should have them.
Are renowned for lengthy parliamentary party meetings, but at the end of the day, should they not come together? And the nature of party politics is that you vote with your team.
None of this changes the fact that Nessa is an excellent TD, and particularly in the health area, she highlights very important roles in terms of how the resources are being used, the dangers in terms of slant to care, in terms of public-private, the lack of services for children in terms of psychological and psychiatric services.
See her stance and that of Patrick also within the broader issues, you know, facing the Green Party. Is this reopening existing lines? You know, particularly there's a very, very strong female cohort in the Green Party. Like, I mean, where does this, is this reopening existing problems, and what does it say about the overall health of the Green Party?
Well, I'd like to think that it's relatively healthy, and each of these experiences instruct us as to how we proceed in the future. There's still continued respect for both Nessa and Patrick, and an expectation that after the 6 months they'll be fully contributing, and contributing in the interim. They haven't stopped being Green Party members, they haven't stopped promoting Green Party policy or anything like that.
I thought one of the more unusual suggestions was that she may leave the Green Party and run alongside Mary Lou MacDonald.
But I don't think
Sinn Féin like undisciplined TDs like Nessa Horrigan.
And it is one of those issues that was, I don't know who wrote a great piece during the week kind of saying, you know, what you get when if Greens leave and go to Sinn Féin, is it a dark green that you get? Nessa Horrigan says of that, she reckons that Mary Lou MacDonald has no shortage of excellent candidates to be her running mate. Could she be one of them? She says, I don't envisage it. But
the lack of environmental green credentials as well as the recent solid fuel regulations.
It comes down to the whole thing of politics.
Of being against carbon taxes.
It comes down to the whole thing of politics being trade-offs, and sometimes those can be within your party. Can you support what the majority view is? But it also comes down to personal as well. And she may have felt so strongly about the National Maternity Hospital that she had to draw a line in the sand on the issue and say, well, I don't support it. There is a vote, and I'm not going to just cross my fingers behind my back and just go with the general line. This is something that I feel very strongly about.
Yeah, and she does confirm she hopes to run as a Green Party candidate in the next general election. She's ruling out crossing over. But I suppose really it's more, Philip, isn't it, than just being seen or perceived to be part of, you know, the awkward squad. It's significant, I suppose, in the gradually then subtly nature of politics when things can shift very quickly. Has it sort of emboldened Sinn Féin? Has it emboldened other independents, do you think?
independence is in the one thing I don't understand about it is that, like, as far as, like, politicians are out looking for votes, I can't see a whole lot of votes in this next time around in Dublin Central. I live out there. I don't think people are worrying themselves about the site of the National Children's Hospital or the National Maternity Hospital. Look, at the next election, it's going to be a tough one for the Greens. They're going to put through an awful lot of tough policies which are going to hurt people in financial terms. But then if you are a Green supporter, and there was a lot in the last election, that you'll be quite impressed by some of the achievements that Eamon Ryan has succeeded in. And I think that's kind of where maybe Horrigan and Costello are kind of losing out on, if they're not seen as being supportive of all the the very significant Green measures that have been pushed through and more to come. If they're seen as not aligned with that, they could lose out further.
Well, I think, in fairness, one example of that, which only occurred this weekend, where NASA was very involved and will continue to reap the benefits, was the pedestrianisation of Capel Street, which NASA's TD, Kieran Cuff as an MEP, Janet Horner as a local councillor, were very active in promoting and seeing coming about. And that's a physical representation of how the Greens want to change the way we're living.
But it is. But at the same time, you know, look, again, if you read John Drennan's piece, he says, as well, as ministers have been told, have to get permission to travel abroad. It says uncertainty is also high over the capacity of the Greens to stay the course. You know, one senior Fine Gael source noted of the response to Nessa Horrigan and Patrick Costello's departures, it was pretty limp wristed. It looked like one of those JA suspensions after an All Ireland where you're suspended for 6 months. But I suppose there is a discord, Dan, towards the Greens, or had they already lost the votes when they went into power into this coalition?
I think that there was a problem in relation to some party members who would actively reject that as an option, mainly because of the last experience. And going into government also means taking responsibility and risking unpopularity. But being in the Green Party, as Philip has already alluded to, means risking unpopularity, because we advocate policies that are hard to get across and hard to get general acceptance, because we believe in a bigger picture and a longer term approach to politics.
Yeah, someone says this was always going to happen with the Green Party. This is what happens with smaller parties in coalition governments. Jennifer, just to go back to that piece, because you did pick it out by John Drennan, lots of unnamed ministers being quoted in it, but one said that Eamon Ryan, the Green Party leader, is going to be the ruination of us yet. Turf will hand rural Ireland over to Sinn Féin.
And we've already had the turf war, so to say. But I do think, though, that there is going to be a certain section of the population that, say, would have been very much engaged by repeal, that will actually remember the National Maternity Hospital. So I don't think that I would be completely discounting the effect.
And yet, why wasn't, like, I know the Twitter thing has been very, very strong, and indeed it has divided women, I think, a lot. There's been a lot of sort of debate on it. But it, as I think as Brenda Power has pointed out, she was saying that, you know, never mind the paucity of genuine public concern over the move that was evidenced by what she describes as the pitiful turnout at last weekend's rally outside the Dáil, despite being supported by Amnesty International and others. You know, so
it is peak communion and confirmation season, though, as well. So a lot of the women and their partners that might be want to attend are busy dealing
Even
with their
very
kids.
Ironic.
exactly. But the thing is that, like, a lot of people I've been speaking to from across the divide, different ages, everything.
I couldn't oppose religious ethos because I was at the Holy Communion. Is probably one of the funnier ones.
At the back of their head, when you talk to them about it, in the back of their head, they do have a query about what's
going
on.
Well, just on women and their role and what they can do in politics. I don't know if you've been following the absolutely amazing things overnight in Australia, where the Conservative Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, who has been widely dubbed as Australia's Trump, was rejected by the electorate there. We're joined now, I've been fascinated by this, by John Butler, The Guardian's political reporter in Australia. Josh, is it morning or evening? What time are we coming to you at?
It's 8:30 p.m. here right now. I've literally just gotten off a plane back to Canberra from being in Sydney overnight for the election night events here last night.
So it has been described variously this morning as a profound realignment of Australian politics since the 1970s. Just remind us who was ousted and who has come in as his replacement.
Yeah, sure. So the Australian government for the last 9 years has been the Liberal National Coalition, which is centre right, you know, conservative government here. We've been through a few prime ministers here. That probably made the news over there. Australia's been through a few prime ministers in the last few years, but that was the prime minister was a guy called Scott Morrison. So he came in as prime minister, you know, just before the last election, you know, 3 or 4 years ago, and he's now been essentially turfed out. Coming in is the Labor Party government. They're a centre-left party. The talk about the realignment is really interesting, though, because, I mean, you know, there's 151 seats in Australia's parliament, so you've got to have 76 to be the government. The Labor Party is currently on about 73. Mm. So they're just short of a majority there. The realignment we're talking about is the Liberal Party has lost a number of their really key long-term, what we call sort of blue ribbon seats here, which has been in the Liberal Party for, you know, as long as Australia's had a parliament, almost, you know, 100 years. They've lost these seats to a number of independent MPs that are focusing on issues around climate change and integrity, especially, you know, there's a big call here for an anti-corruption commission to investigate government and politicians and that sort of thing. So the realignment is not so much that you know, one party or the other has, you know, the other major parties taken over the other major parties' seats. It's that these new climate and integrity focused independent MPs have come in and essentially knocked the Liberal heartland out of the Liberal Party.
Yeah, and Anthony Albanese, I know it's the Italian pronunciation. Yeah. really interesting character, son of a single mother. He grew up in public housing in Sydney. He sort of, I suppose, rose on the back of promises, as you say, about climate and about anti-corruption. And I'm just wondering, was this the climate change election in a country that has, you know, huge reliance on those commodities? Or was it a rejection of kind of what some people said was a very blokish, kind of misogynistic, this ScoMo government that has been there? Or was it elements of all of those things?
Yeah, it's definitely elements of both, and I think we're still sort of understanding the ratio of which one, you know, what to what number between those two things, the split between those two things. You know, I was at the Labor Party, you know, the incoming government's election night event last night in the city. There was, you know, 1,000 people there in Sydney almost at this event where he made his victory speech, Anthony Albanese. Even people there, you know, like Labor Party staffers, you know, at that time, they were saying to me, we see this as being a rejection of the Liberal Party rather than a massive ringing endorsement of the Labor Party. And like I said, the Labor Party still hasn't got a majority of seats yet. They probably will. They might just squeak over the line. But, partly too, and the Labor Party also ran very strongly on the idea that they weren't Scott Morrison, that Morrison was criticised a lot for, you know, not taking responsibility and for lying and for being sneaky and all those sorts of things. The Labor Party ran very hard on this idea of just that, you know, people were fed up with Scott Morrison and vote the guy out to change politics in this country. So it's definitely both those things.
Yeah, and obviously, like, and we're sitting here discussing our own domestic politics, but obviously issues such as rising inflation, interest rates, the cost of living, geopolitical instability, to what extent will that, I suppose, pose a challenge to Anthony Albanese in forming and maintaining his government?
Yeah, those things. I mean, like Australian interest rates, just there was an interest rate rise here, the official interest rate rise. It went from 0.1% to, I think, 0.2. So it's very, very low interest rates here, but it was a major factor, a major sort of discussion and talking point here in the election. Obviously, you know, we're at a time here. Obviously, you and Europe are far closer to this geographically than us, but we're talking about, you know, these geopolitical tensions in you know, Russia and the Ukraine and all those parts of the world. There are challenges here. I think this has been a long time since the Labor Party's been in government. There are a lot of talk in Australia about defence and about national security. Like, you know, there's a lot of talk about China here in Australia and what threat China potentially poses to Australia. So these are all questions I think that the Labor Party really will have to deal with. This is a time when either party would have been really challenged in government, but these are challenges that the Labor Party is really going to have to answer now.
As a political leader, Scott Morrison was neither blessed amongst women or blessed by them, but lots of pictures overnight of the women who have been elected, and I'm just wondering, is that something that has also come through in this electoral cycle? Has it been a good day for them?
Yeah, look, I mean, as I mentioned a little earlier, I mean, these climate and integrity-focused independents, almost all of them are professional, you know, very highly educated, successful, you know, successful in business often, women. This is a real sort of change that's sweeping through the parliament. It started a little bit at the 2019 election. There was a couple of candidates like that, but there's our crossbench, so which is the MPs who are neither of the main parties, has grown from 6 to 15 at least. Mm. So it's more than doubled in the space of one electoral term there. As I say to you right here, I've actually just seen a news article saying that the Labour Party has just secured majority government here. So they're going to get
Last question I was going to ask you, because I think counting had still been going on, but how much of a majority have they secured?
Look, I think it's just over the line here. I think it's probably about 76 or 77. So they're still counting to go. You know, the Australian system, you know, we do a lot of postal votes and pre-poll votes and that sort of thing.
Of course, you have to vote.
For ages.
You have to vote, which is another...
Yeah, it's compulsory here.
Yeah, we've one listener, Josh, just before I let you go, who says, finally, the green agenda is impacting in Australia. We're all in trouble if they don't make that change there. Is this a hint of things moving in the right direction?
Look, I think so, and I hope so. I think, you know, Australia has gone through what we call the climate wars here. You know, Anthony Albanese campaigned on saying, you know, I will end the climate wars. You know, I think this is a good sign. I think Australians want climate action. They want things to change, and this election shows that.
Another listener says, I believe Albanese's mother is Irish. We'll have to check that out, for we love nothing more than a good local angle. But I don't feel too guilty about kicking you up too late. But Josh Butler, The Guardian's political reporter in Australia, thank you for bringing us for live updates on that. Dan Boyle, just coming back to you, a lot of debate about it. Obviously, Josh has given us more context, but could this be a significant win for the climate agenda for a country such as Australia, countries?
I think it's quite significant. It seems to be the first general election of any country where climate change has been a deciding factor. Scott Morrison, you have to remember, is someone who brought a lump of coal into the Australian Parliament to show what a wonderful substance it was. And I think there are a lot of things happening in Australia at the moment. The Greens have gone from one seat in the lower house to 6 and 9 in the Senate. In fact, Labour don't have a majority in the Senate, so it'll still be a minority government in that sense. So, and the independents, as the reporters already mentioned, are largely elected on climate change basis. So it's going to be a complete reversal. The Australian government over the last 10 years has been appalling in international conventions on the environment. So it can only bring about a good result. And another good effect, I think, is it likely to see the end of Pauline Hanson and her One Nation party, who's not going to win her seat in the Senate, and appalling bigot, and it shows a dramatic change of direction.
I suppose Australia had kind of moved quite far to the right, and maybe that's been a rejection of that as well. Well, listen, we've been talking non-stop for 35 minutes. Let's have a very, very quick break.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Very welcome back, Dermot McDonald, sitting in for Brendan, and surrounded this morning in studio by Philip Ryan, political editor at Independent Newspapers, Dan Boyle, Green Party councillor, and Dr. Jennifer Cavanagh, law lecturer at the South Eastern Technological University. Philip, I just want to go to you. The lead story and it was after such a mad tweet that we saw earlier this week. Fianna Fáil bot tweets. Our Fianna Fáil believes political opponents are using bot accounts bought from Click Farms to discredit members and create a false impression that the party is buying social media influence. It was so random when Stephen Donnelly's tweet got retweeted from 300 Turkish accounts.
Yeah, but it's not the first time, though, Fianna Fáil have been hit with this. There's been a couple of other examples over the last year or two where TDs have put up their videos, you know, or promotional stuff for the party, and suddenly you get this influx of accounts with Turkish handles or Turkish names putting it out there. Now, it's something that's quite easily done. There's a couple of websites, you can just Google them and ask them to buy retweets, and it doesn't even cost that much. It's only
and
a few euros.
There was sort of a mad suggestion, did they do it themselves? But that doesn't really hold.
No, it'd be kind of, well, you don't know that at the same time. If you were doing it, would you admit to doing it? I'm not sure you would. But it seems a little bit amateurish if they did do it. And this idea that someone else was doing it, I don't think we're talking Russian interference here. We're not going to need Robert Mueller on board to look into this one. But there's some sort of play acting going on. I'd say it's someone just bored at home.
Can I go to two interviews? We've already mentioned one of them, but I think it's worth going back to. But there's two political interviews of note, actually three, in fact, in the papers. One with Fine Gael's Joe McHugh, Nessa Harrigan, of course, and with also with Mick Wallace. Jennifer, what was really, really interesting when you move away from the politics and go to the personal is that Hugh O'Connell, in his interview with Nessa Harrigan, is saying that there's been perspective for her in terms of this vote, because her husband, who had been quite ill in hospital for most of the last 6 months and had only returned home in recent days, she says there's a lot of running from the Dáil to pick up the children from school. I have three kids under 10. It's been stressful. She says her daughter, the eldest of three, has been blind since birth and needs a lot of support. All of this puts her decision to vote against the government last week, earning her, as we know, that 6 month suspension, a distant second to other priorities in her life. And I think it's Joe McHugh in the Sun, the Business Post as well, the talking about the personal impact of a life in politics.
Yeah, I mean, it is very tough. I mean, Nessa Horgan is based in Dublin. Joe McHugh, as far as I recall, is Donegal based. But there's, you know, no matter how close or far you live away from it, it takes up so much time in your life. And then there's the social media, the harassment that politicians get. Women tend to get more of that than men. And it comes to a certain stage where, say women who are being encouraged to run for politics may have a very good career and may look at it and say, why would I actually get myself dragged into all of that life? Because, I mean, the amount of councillors now whose kids won't even go into the shop with them if they're getting a bottle of milk because it'll take 2 hours. Because it won't just be getting a bottle of milk, it'll be bumping into everyone. And just on that, the bots on Twitter, just one other point with that story. With the Electoral Reform Bill, they are going to bring in some form of say, transparency on buying of political ads or buying of, you know, extra clicks. This is now something that legislation is going to have to look at as well, because it won't just be buying an ad. Yeah.
Philip, I actually got it wrong. It's actually in the Business Post, that interview with Joe McHugh. Mm. And look, it notes other retirements from politics, particularly for Fine Gael. You know, Owen Murphy had left, Michael Darcy, both retired from active politics. But Joe McHugh, in his interview with Michael Brennan, one, he had a health crisis that he has happily recovered from. But the second was that it was the pandemic really... made him, he said he wanted to spend more time with his young family, that it made him really, really rethink the toll, I suppose, of a life in politics.
Sure. Just one little thing that stood out to me from that interview took place while Dame Maggie Smith from Downton Abbey was sitting across from
him. I had seen that.
it seems, look, this is always comes up with politics, and Joe McHugh has done and served in the Dáil for 20 years. That's quite a long time. If you're being cynical, you could say he gets his full pension after that time as well. But
He still served his time
and he served as a minister, and he dealt with everything that comes with that. And I think, like a lot of people during the pandemic...
And he's gracious towards Leo Varadkar in terms of, you know, having obviously had a very senior role and then kind of, you know, he sort of acknowledges that that he'd gone as high as he could go.
And Enda Kenny as well, like even though he voted against Enda back all the way back in 2010, he was also appointed as a Minister of State for the Gaeltacht, and he's very thankful for that. But look, time moves on and people want different challenges, and at a certain age, like, you're obviously looking at your young children and thinking, you know,
he's still a young man. But
and representing Donegal in particular is a difficult constituency.
And COVID's made a big difference, because a lot of politicians were able to just focus on just going to and from the Dáil and having their virtual meetings. Like turning up at funerals was gone, turning up at opening the local GA centre was gone. And I think coming out of COVID, a lot see the extra things that they took as normal in their job, and now they realise there's a different way of living life.
Dan Boyle, we were discussing this yesterday, just in terms of actually the hospitality sector post COVID, and I know as the Great Resignation, which I've written about, has perhaps been overstated, but these you know, this kind of life balance, family, quality of life has come up, and it's feeding into all sorts of things, including the staffing crises and that war for talent, which is also hugely dominant across the papers today.
No, I completely identify with what's being said about Joe McHugh and Nessa herself. I mean, Nessa's family situation only increases the respect she has within the Green Party. But from a personal experience, when I was a TD, I was also party whip, which is a job I shouldn't have accepted. And I wasn't a very hard taskmaster. It wasn't only making sure that people were available for the votes, it was to make sure the speaking slots were also filled. And very often they weren't, which meant I had to do it myself. And I should add that Eamon Ryan was particularly bad in not asking to do what he was meant to do, what he was meant to do. But that meant I would have been, I was 250 kilometres away in my home. In terms of my family, it obviously had. My relationship with my daughter was affected for several years because I just wasn't physically there. And what would have been a 3-day week very often turned out to be a 5-day week. I don't think there's a lack of proper understanding for people, particularly outside of the Dublin area, who are members of the Oireachtas and the types of supports they need and the impact that their jobs have on their family situations.
Yeah, it's less of a softer style interview, Philip Ryan, but Ali Bracken has an interview with Mick Wallace, which is of interest and is strong and as dominant as you would expect from him.
Yeah, and it's just wall-to-wall quotes as well of standout quotes. And I think one of the standout bits for me, though, he addresses what is the kind of the Ross and Rachel of Friends of Irish politics, is that relationship between himself and Claire Daly. And he's asked, like, what is the nature of their relationship? Is it purely platonical? And he says, yeah, it's a professional relationship. We work well together. I've been accused of relationships with lots of women. I haven't time for romance. I'm too busy saving the planet.
I thought that was a great line. I have time for romance. Too busy.
Lion King doesn't have a lioness,
seems. And I'm actually nearly even conflicted about that, because, you know, to what extent should people be interrogated about the nature of their relationships unless it impacts on their political life? But he addressed it full on, and but it makes for an interesting mix of political interviews right across the board this morning. I want to move on to what constitutes the lead story in the Sunday Independent, which is that rather sensitive, sorry, I'm rustling papers away here, but sure, it wouldn't be a newspaper panel show without it, would it? A sensitive cabinet memo, Dan Boyle, that has been presented in respect, I suppose, of the realities of dealing with the, I think, almost 30,000 Ukrainian refugees that have been welcomed in Ireland, talking about the challenges not only for the refugees themselves and the services that they require, including housing, education, health, but also the challenges facing the communities to which they are received in.
Well, I think, to be fair, every political issue and situation requires risk assessments, and it's somewhat reassuring that forward planning is based on the fact that these risks, their potential risks, are being acknowledged and recognised.
Because we're nearly afraid of them, because nobody wants to be seen to be speaking against, because these people are fleeing war and persecution.
Yeah, I wouldn't have a fear that the weight that's being attached or the inference being given that it's a realisable risk. But we should acknowledge that it's a risk that exists. I think the public good will exist and will be maintained into the future. I think the bigger risk actually is for Ukrainians themselves as they integrate into Irish society in the medium term and long term, because they have a right for employment as of now. Securing employment is not going to be difficult. There are a lot of job opportunities out there. But going from a situation...
Well, that's assuming that you have workable English
and particular match with professions. There are a lot of professional people. I've met quite a lot of them.
Well, of the 31,000 people who've been issued with PPS numbers, the majority of them, 28,500, are being issued with, you know, income support revenue records. At just under 2,000 have arrived in Ireland with active employment, with just over 1,000 employers across a wide range of jobs. Philip, I suppose, whilst we're being sensitive, the Sunday Independent is stark. It says that this memo says that the arrival of tens of thousands of refugees into towns and cities across the country poses a risk to social cohesion and integration, particularly among deprived communities that may have their own struggles in respect of access to housing, education, to healthcare.
Yeah, this is, look, it's a natural concern, I think, for people out there. While there is all that goodwill, and there was that initial burst of goodwill when everybody was given over their houses, but then they sat down and thought about it for a minute and decided, well, I'm not going to go ahead with that. But then if you're living, like you say, in a rural community and you're struggling for school places, you're struggling for to get access to GPs, you're struggling for all sorts of services, and then you're suddenly getting 100, if not thousands of people moving into your district, like naturally you're going to be concerned about what my access to the services will be. And I think that's this piece from Hugh O'Connell, like you're not going to see the government come out and say this in a press release. This is the kind of the quiet bit being said loudly in that, like, this is a concern that they're not going to come out and say. You wouldn't say it on a show like this. You wouldn't write a column about it because, you know, the online would go crazy and you'd be cancelled or something like that. But it is a fear that's within communities out there, and you can either, you know, try demonize people for thinking this, or you can try put their fears at ease by finding some ways to allay those fears.
Jennifer, we have received praise for, I suppose, the welcome that we have extended to Ukrainian refugees in particular, but obviously against the background of a system of asylum and integration that hasn't always won plaudits.
Yeah, I mean, the Ukrainian refugees are coming in under a different scheme to the what would have been there with the direct provision. And we've also taken in a lot from Afghanistan as well. Like, I was involved in a training school for female Afghan judges who are coming over here. But it's always an issue when you do have a massive influx that is changing the social dynamics. And we know, and, you know, it's quite clear there is elements of certain more fringe political movements that would try and capitalise on that to basically just make trouble. But there, as Philip said, if you're in a small community, you know, you can't get onto a GP list to begin with, and then everyone else is coming in. It's again, COVID and this issue are just showing up the cracks that are there in social provision in Ireland, and we just need to get on with fixing it, because it's always we'll take learnings, but you'd be wondering if those learnings are ever applied.
Yeah, there is extensive coverage still, including featuring many interviews with new members of our community here. Philip, there is it's related to the war, but kind of slightly a little bit upbeat. There's two special kind of doggy stories. One was on the front of the Irish Daily Star Sunday about the Russian dog that has defected to the Ukrainian army, but there's also the one of this the remarkable little Jack Russell, who has I think his name means bullet, patron, who has been, he's become like, he's on billboards all over Ukraine because of the work that he's doing. But it's quite a remarkable story. It's a wee picture of him standing on top of Russian ordnance, no fear of all of those bombs.
Yeah, he's just a pet of Mykolai Ilyev, I think, one of the soldiers who just started bringing him into work, because he didn't have anybody at home, and he's been hanging around with the defence forces over there since he was 2 months old. And then he just picked up this skill where he can sniff out the mines and detect them. And he's like, how many did he say? Is it like 1,000 or 200 that he's been able to find in recent times? And I think just looking at the pictures is what
And he's got over 250.
He's just a good boy, isn't he?
He's just a good boy, and he's got over 250,000 followers on his Instagram account. Now, one story that is not dominating the Irish headlines, but is very, very strong in the UK, and possibly because we haven't yet, I'm sure it may come, we haven't yet had a case of monkeypox in Ireland, but obviously there is an outbreak in the UK, and it dominates a lot of the coverage there. And I just thought we might just go to GP Maura Finn in Ennis, County Clare, maybe just to bring us a little bit of an update on what it might mean for you. You're very, very welcome to the programme, Maura.
Good morning, Darvel. How are you?
Really good. Listen, there's over 100 cases of monkeypox have been reported across Europe. And I know it's endemic to parts of Western and Central Africa. I think Nigeria has something like 3,000 reported cases a year alone. But the rise in cases elsewhere, particularly in Europe, Canada, the US, is unusual. What do we need to know about this virus?
Well, I think the reason that we're concerned and we are talking about it is because it has been atypical, the spread so far. As you say, it's endemic in certain parts of Africa, but now it's spreading in countries where it would not normally circulate. And I suppose WHO and, you know, the CDC are actually concerned whether or not the virus is changing. It may not be the case, but there has been a large number of cases in Spain, Portugal, UK. What we need to know, I suppose, is rather not cause a lot of concern about it. There's no point in kind of increasing anxiety. We're just getting over the COVID anxiety. But to know what it is and how it spreads. So it's a virus that's been identified since the 50s, and it normally spreads from animal to animal or animal to human. Classically, there's a long incubation period, but the classic symptoms are a fever, a high fever over 38 degrees, headache, muscle aches and pains, fatigue, swollen lymph nodes, that's very classic, and a very particular rash. And the rash starts as these tiny little spots that then develop into raised kind of swollen pustules, and then they break down and scab over. And they're very, very classic. And that's how the diagnosis is actually made. Now, diagnosis is proven by other lab tests, but it's the clinical picture that would kind of shows the diagnosis.
And we know that, well, I think we can assume that because of international travel that it may come here. And I know the HSE has set up a multidisciplinary team to look at it. I think there's kind of two versions, one which has quite a high incidence of death. That's not the one that seems to be at issue here. But is there a treatment for it, or are we a victim of the success of eradicating smallpox that maybe we're not up to date on treatments for it?
Well, actually, the smallpox vaccine was the very first vaccine ever developed. But because of its success, we haven't been vaccinating internationally since the 1970s. So, but it is shown that the smallpox vaccine does provide protection against monkeypox. I'm not sure if that's ever going to be needed, that people will be vaccinated. What's really most important is that people understand the symptoms. Transmission occurs when you have a rash. So that's really important. So if people know about this, and if they know that an unusual rash that is associated with this illness is the time when you could transmit this illness, then that public awareness campaign is probably the most important thing. And it really needs to be balanced between public awareness and not increasing anxiety in the general public, because it is quite a rare disease, and it is spread by very close, intimate contact.
Well, hopefully that is the case, and hopefully we will be better placed in terms of our public health response as a result of the COVID outbreak. Maura Finn, GP and Ennis County Clare, thank you for joining us this morning. Jennifer, I wanted to go to you on the lead story in the Irish Mail on Sunday, because we are travelling more. And I have to say, and this is a little bit female, I cannot believe that a gun got through Dublin Airport when everybody knows that there's a certain type of brassiere that you wear that will automatically trigger security.
And I mean, for people who
women know this, women listening know it, and they know the brand.
We know exactly the brand, not to wear it.
We know exactly the bra and the brand.
They will even advise you of that in Dublin Airport as well when it starts beeping to begin with. But it's kind of crazy to think all this is getting through when people have been going through such lengthy queues in Dublin Airport. And, you know, I have been travelling now again, thankfully, since things eased up. But the amount of people who've completely forgotten about that you can't have liquids in your bag going through Dublin Airport. I think one of the Western airports has now changed because they've upgraded their scanners, so you can. But if you're going somewhere else, you'll still have to have your liquids in a bag. But it's incredibly frustrating to say, oh, there was training, they lost so many staff, and you can get pulled over. I mean, my mother got pulled once for having one lipstick too many. And yet there is so many things that seem to be getting through this audit. It's quite frustrating.
Well, at least there is an audit of it. Another audit of a different kind, Jennifer, just to stay with you, is that on the vacant houses. I think it's a piece in the Business Post. And obviously this was a big, big major commitment as part of the housing strategy. And now I suggest that maybe it couldn't, shouldn't, mightn't go ahead.
Yes. Well, meanwhile, people can't move apartments. They're still stuck in rental apartments. There's just so much in housing where we'll do it, this is a great idea, but then afterwards, actually, no, that's not going to work. And again, it's the whole thing of, you know, are we learning from the problems that are happening, or the way policy has been done properly? And you have, with Ukrainians as well coming over, they need somewhere to live. But also students, when they come back to college again in September, there's been significant problems with getting student accommodation, even in the last academic year, with students who are, say, commuting from Nace down to Waterford on a daily basis because they can't get accommodation.
Philip, it's an emotive issue, and yet when you go into kind of the detail of it, some of the reasons kind of can seem quite reasonable. They're saying that there may be very significant reasons why a house may be vacant and the data wasn't enough. But it is a very, very emotive issue because it was a crunch point in the last housing plan.
Yeah, look, there's if they can get these things up and running, actually in use, it would be a great service for trying to deal with this shortage. But I don't think it's the overall solution for the housing crisis. Like the reality is, you just need to build them and build every different type and whatever types there are. If there's international people coming in, if they're build locally, we just need every type of housing going. So I think this is a small part of the solution to the crisis overall.
I would be concerned though, because I think the greenest house is a house that's already built, and I think a lot of the excuses that are being offered about not proceeding with the vacant sites houses act levy are wrong, and I think it's just an attempt not to make sure that the property market is influenced to too negative a sense and prices aren't depressed too much, which has influenced too much of our housing policy over the last number of decades.
And well, Cork seems to have a specific problem with our election.
We are very good activists who have identified hundreds of vacant properties
in Cork. It does indeed. But listen, before we wrap up, let's take a very quick break.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Well, welcome back. They're still nattering away there. One of the texters says the look of derelict houses across the country is just horrendous. Even if it looks worse than it is a blight on our rural tides. I take it as a matter of pride that goes through an entire hour of the panel without using the B word Brexit. We didn't even get to the protocol or any of those other issues. It must be a sign that nature is healing. But lots today that we didn't get to. But to Philip Ryan, political editor at Independent Newspapers, to Dan Boyle, Green Party councillor and former TD, Senator and Chairperson of the Green Party, and also to Dr. Jennifer Kavanagh, Law Lecturer at Southeastern Technological University. Thank you for joining me this morning. It's time to cross over to Kate Egan, who's reading the news.